Good day, and welcome to the special audio conference presented today by Pike & Fisher, publisher of the Digital Discovery and e-Evidence Newsletter and Web Reference Service. Our audio conference entitled E-Discovery Secrets, How to Build a Process for Success, will run for 90 minutes. The final 15 minutes or so will be devoted to questions and answers. You can send any questions that occur to you while the program is in progress by emailing them to audio@pf.com. We'll hold them until we're ready for the Q&A session to begin. You can also pose your question by phone. I'll be back to explain how that works just before we move to Q&A. After the audio conference, you'll receive an email with a link to an evaluation form. We do ask each person listening to today's event to take a moment to fill this out, so if the registrant for the call could forward it to others listening, that would be appreciated. Your feedback is very important and extremely valuable. Also, your request for CLA credit is administered through the online evaluation form, which makes completing them even more important. CLEs cannot be given without a completed evaluation form. Audio recordings of today's sessions are available for purchase. To order, call 1-800-401-5937 to receive a special price for attendees. Now, to begin this audio conference, I am pleased to welcome our moderator, Carl A. Shinneman, Vice President, Special Counsel Incorporated. Sir, please go ahead.
Thank you for at least witnessing the beginning of the program, which illustrates e-discovery at its finest. Nothing goes as planned with technology. First, I'd like to introduce the panel. I call this the Electronic Discovery All-Star Team. Please look over their bios for a more accurate description, but this is how I describe each of them. Jim Michowitz from Altman Weil. Everyone seems to know Jim. He's sort of like the Kevin Bacon of electronic discovery in that regard. He's a Six Sigma expert who at DuPont and Tyco wrote books, articles, and basically would tell anyone who would listen how they could get smarter in areas such as electronic discovery. He now sells his knowledge as a consultant at Altman Weil. Kevin Esposito from Pfizer is still not as smart as Jim Michowitz because he doesn't sell his knowledge to the outside world, but he's extremely knowledgeable in this area. Like Jim, Kevin's frequently the keynote speaker at National Electronic Discovery Conferences. What is unique about Kevin is he wears both an attorney's hat and the propeller cap of technology. Those are actually Kevin's words. Chris Olson's from the international law firm Reed Smith. Chris has 20 years of process engineering and operations management experience creating and running automation processes on huge projects all over the country. Chris represents an innovative approach in litigation support management at a major law firm because he's a technical person and not an attorney, yet he has significant responsibility at the firm to craft effective and successful solutions. Dave Cohen's a partner at the international law firm of Kirkpatrick & Lockhart and co-chair of the firm's electronic discovery practice. He's also half of the Simon & Garfunkel of electronic discovery. He and Tom Stevens, also from this panel, brought down the house at a New York electronic discovery conference with a version of You Don't Bring Me Paper sung to You Don't Bring Me Flowers. Dave's a Harvard lawyer who also wears proudly the propeller cap of technology. Tom Stevens is a VP at ACT Litigation, a national technology company. And when he's not singing about electronic discovery, he has worked on thousands of litigation projects. He's not an attorney, but he has a technology and process focus. Tom frequently speaks at electronic discovery conferences on ways to improve process and is a big advocate of vendor, client, and law firm collaboration. Tim Kuhn is a partner at the Pittsburgh-based law firm of Eckert Siemens. He's coordinated a number of electronic discovery projects, including one numbering several hundred contract attorneys. Tim, of all the expert panelists, is the only one I would hire as a contract attorney, as he spent a long weekend coding with a team a few years ago, day and night, to help hit a deadline, which they did. And as such, he's truly an expert on how war rooms with contract attorneys operate. Tim's also aware of the propeller cap of technology. Tess Blair is a partner at the national law firm of Morgan Lewis. Tess, that's international, too, I think, correct?
A little bit, yes.
Yeah, I've given everyone else international. Tess runs a business unit at Morgan Lewis focusing on electronic discovery. She's the only attorney in the world with a certificate in law firm management, and is halfway through a master's degree that's the equivalent of an MBA in professional service firm business management. And what I find even more remarkable, she's also the only lawyer I know who doesn't require any sleep whatsoever. And then Tim Opsitnik, or as we respectfully call him, Mr. Opsitnik, it's because we have two Tims on the panel, is a former Jones Day litigator who, after running some huge projects, decided to go full-time with his true passion of technology. Tim helped to create the national e-discovery think tank, the Sedona Conference. He is the CEO of Cleveland-based Juranov, a legal technology company with electronic discovery expertise, and he frequently consults on extremely large electronic discovery projects. My background is I'm a vice president at National Legal Staffing Company Special Counsel. I look at myself more as a Carnegie Mellon MBA and a former entrepreneur who never really wanted to be a lawyer, but became one in 91 due to a bad economy. Then he mixed in some public accounting at Pricewaterhouse and a passion for process improvement, along with platform of seeing lots of these types of projects. And you get someone who has the ability to analyze the messy world of electronic discovery and write articles and do fun programs like this. So anyway, the ground rules is, you know, what's really fun about electronic discovery is it continues to evolve and improve. And I don't know of anybody who can say that they handle this area perfectly yet, but by focusing openly and candidly on issues that come up and talking as a multidisciplinary group of experts with technologists here, lawyers, MBAs, HR people, operations people, we hope to continue to improve this field of electronic discovery for all of us, including not just the listeners, but also us as panelists. Today we're going to analyze a messy project through 12 steps of a piece of litigation. The fact pattern I'm presenting is not real in its entirety. It's based on real situations that have occurred on projects. Most of these examples are third-hand descriptions of messes. Some of the issues that occur in many, if not most, projects, and some of the issues described have no answers yet. We're going to talk for about 6 minutes on each of these 12 sections of the case, and I'm going to briefly summarize key points. I'm not going through all the issues that are in the fact pattern. It could be 8 hours worth of material there, but we decided it would be valuable still to paint a picture for people that want to look at projects to get a sense of how complicated these can be. If you have a BlackBerry or other PDAs, you can email questions to me at audio@pf.com. We're going to save 5 to 10 minutes at the end for questions, and feel free to follow up with any of the panelists with questions you might have. I think we included their emails in the materials. Okay, let's go now. The fact pattern involves an allegedly defective bottle of Cabernet, which my fictitious company marketed as the fourth C of e-discovery, to lawyers. If the seminal electronic discovery case of Zubelock counsels that there are three C's in electronic discovery, communicate your hold strategy, coordinate your electronic document collection, and comply with your discovery order, then there must be a fourth C somewhere, and we decided it was Cabernet for when things go wrong. All went well for my company until lawyers drinking 4C around the country began missing deadlines. We were then sued for an allegedly defective product. In the first section of technology, choosing a technology platform, the key facts were 4C was facing lawsuits for being allegedly defective. We scrambled. We asked our outside counsel, Mikowitz, Esposito, and Opsitnik, that's a law firm name only a mother could love, to help us locate a technology vendor. We reviewed marketing materials for dozens of vendors. We got confused. Eventually, we chose to rent startup software because we liked their demonstration. It had good deduping of email features. The founder came from an established large software company, and the software could be used as a trial database. We were under heavy pressure to commence discovery. I'd like to start with a general question first. Jim, we spent a lot of time trying to figure out the best software vendor. Do you have any suggestions for how you would start an electronic discovery project?
Yeah, I guess what I'd like to offer is kind of like a roadmap to maybe help support the three C's that you talked about before, Carl. And there may be some variations to this, but as part of the early case assessment or litigation, I'd offer the following steps. Number one, the define stage, which is define the scope. Identify, which is to identify key custodians and locations of information. Preservation. Harvesting, which includes the retrieval and collection. And then I call it refining, which includes the processing of data, review, and then produce. And I think it's important that for this roadmap that responsibilities are assigned to each of the individual tasks that fall under these steps to either be in-house resources, either attorneys, paralegals, or IT personnel, or outside counsel and service providers. And I think it's really important that to actually map out this process all the way through production and have roles and responsibilities assigned to each of those and actually have a sign-off.
Kevin, the number one question I get, and 4C focus a lot on this, is how do you pick a technology vendor? And is this focus usually overemphasized to the exclusion of other facets of the review?
Honestly, I find that that really is overemphasized. I think one of the things you have to consider right up front is what is it that you're trying to accomplish. Before rushing out and trying to find a vendor to assist you, you have to understand what you're trying to do. Are you looking for someone who's going to be helping you with acquisition of data, processing of data, hosting of data, or production of data? You might use a different vendor depending upon what you need to accomplish. You also need to take a look at the technical abilities of your team and that of outside counsel that's assisting you. What can they handle as opposed to having to look outside of your organizations for additional help? And you should consider the needs of the opposing party as well, because it doesn't do you any good to build a better mousetrap if the other side can't make use of it.
Great. Hey, Chris, why is it so important to pick the right vendors for your electronic discovery projects?
Thanks, Carl. Vendor selection is probably the most critical component in terms of outsourcing to successfully conclude a project. It's important to understand, and I think that this is my key message, that all vendors are not created equal. You need to look at vendors in terms of their expertise and services offered, the quality, capacity, track record, industry reputation. There's a lot of factors, and they vary greatly. To add to that, this is a mature industry, and I believe the demand of experienced people to provide these types of services has outstripped the supply of experienced litigation support candidates. Therefore, in a mature industry, there's many vendors entering the industry, not only vendors but law firms, corporate law departments. We're all vying for these people with those expertise. So finding vendors is increasingly more of a challenge, and to find one that offers true value is the ultimate goal. I recommend that firms perform due diligence in terms of their project requirements, then defining a short list of service providers that offer a best-of-breed approach. Now, partnering with a primary vendor can be very advantageous, and developing that strategic relationship can result in increased value, lower costs, a higher level of trust and confidence between the partners, which is very important, and ultimately a more consistent work product.
Great. Tom, should you start the process of picking a software provider at the start of litigation before it, or do you wait till you have the need and scramble?
Well, thank you, Carl. Most corporations are like the fourth C in that large-scale litigation is a very rare event. So most corporations will not have spent the time prior to being aware of a litigation to seek out vendors and solutions. Our advice is to use that short time that is available to focus on major issues and not on cool factors like were exhibited in the fourth C example. One point in particular that I'd like to make is that it's important from a review administration standpoint to make sure that they believe that they can actually implement the proposed solution. There are many fancy ideas that come up with, but if you don't think you can actually do it or understand how it will be done in practical terms, then you may suffer through the review period.
Tom, or actually Mr. Opsitnik, in preparation for this program, you made some good points comparing when do you rent versus buy the database software. Here we rented. Can you share some of your thoughts?
Sure, Carl. I think there are two considerations. The first one's easy, and that's cost. What we typically look at is if you're going to build it, what are your one-time costs and what are your ongoing costs? And if you're going to rent it, what are your ongoing costs? And we lay down or we break out all the costs, and we try to find a break-even point at which it makes sense from purely a cost standpoint to rent it rather than to buy it. However, that's not the only consideration. The other consideration is the efficiency consideration and the consideration whether or not you really should be in the business of maintaining such a electronic database. And that is because it requires good technology talent to run it and do it right. And do you really have the talent necessary to pull it off, or would you be better served in taking advantage of the talent that others have taken the time to gather for such projects? So it's the second one, which I really think law firms and corporations need to come to grips with, which is whether they should be whether they should even be in the business to maintain such a database.
Tom, the question on all clients' minds and staffing companies, I might add, is should I really expect software search tools to significantly reduce the volume of documents needed to be reviewed by people, perhaps eliminate document review by people altogether?
The key issue, Carl, I think is going to be the defensibility. Virtually all software has the ability to reduce a population, but will the process or tool that was used stand up to scrutiny from the other side? There's a great deal of hope that's being placed in tools such as concept search technology, but we believe even with these more advanced technologies, there will need to be a component of validation that's included in order to support an argument for defensibility. These validation techniques will include statistical types of sampling to demonstrate the efficacy of the tool. As an aside, there is work being done by the Sedona Conference to try to develop a federal standard for these testing methodologies.
Okay, great. Moving into the next section, which is also a technology section of getting data into the system, the 4C with outside counsel put out their hold orders throughout the company. With internal employees in our law firm, we pull documents and electronic data from potential witnesses. There were numerous email systems because our company was a conglomerate built through acquisitions. We had backup tapes that were located. Hundreds of boxes were found in warehouses. And due to the geographic scope of our company, we had to hire several vendors to get the data into a similar format using a spec sheet we'd prepared. The vendors did not follow the instructions, however, so the data was not in the right form. We then decided to hire a large team of contract attorneys to plow through the documents and clean up the database. The staging fees that we paid the company we chose, Startup, were hundreds of thousands of dollars higher than we'd budgeted. These fees were buried in the contract we'd signed with Startup. In addition, the court says we got to produce these documents in native format, which Startup says it can handle. Chris, is the wide variety of databases, email servers, and software used by 4C, which complicated this project, typical of what happens in electronic discovery projects?
Yes, it is, Carl. Many projects, you know, we're talking about an electronic discovery project here, but more often than not, you'll end up with not only native electronic files in various formats, but hard copy documents as well. And the challenge is to process and synthesize all of that information into a common format for document review. And the objective really is to have document reviewers focused on the document review and the substance of the database, not on technical issues. If you can achieve that, or to the extent you can achieve that, you'll end up with better productivity and quality. And again, that points to your due diligence and vendor selection, finding a vendor that's well-versed in those formats and very important as well, can provide project management and consultative advice based on their experience.
Great. Jim, is it a fair strategy to bowl through a flawed process, a collection process with lots of people to clean up horrible data?
Carl, I always love your use of terms. So you call the bowl kind of like the El Matador approach, which I think is pretty reactive, and probably companies that are faced with these huge e-discovery cases for the first time probably is reactive mode. I know having worked for large companies and actually being called working for a professional defendant, we've, I guess, had the luxury of doing some planning. So in my mind, what you're really trying to do is to, especially in the data harvesting area, become more proactive in the strategy and really assign what I call farmers in the Dell for harvesting, which is to really have some in-house resources who really know the processes to collect data like this within the systems. And really almost have a assigned e-discovery specialist. Now, that's not necessarily going to be their full-time job, but to be able to be versatile enough and to do this job. And the only caution I give about the use of in-house resources is you don't necessarily want them on the witness stand. So to have their processes validated by outside counsel and maybe also a forensics provider is probably the best way to go, I think, to reduce risk and also to kind of avoid the El Matador approach.
Great. Tom, I know you have some thoughts on team sizes. How would you as a technology company decide how large your review team would be, and when would you put them in place?
Well, Carl, it's not an absolute science in trying to estimate what the throughput rates are going to be for a particular review. Some documents, such as email, take much more time to review than would, say, very large reports. What we guide our clients with is to estimate approximately 200 pages per hour per reviewer. And so if your goal is to review at a rate of 100,000 pages per week, you can do that math fairly shortly. As to when the review team should start, I can tell you from experience that if you run your review team with inventory showing up just in time, it will shorten your life. Try to keep a pad there so that you always have more inventory on hand than you actually need. A rule of thumb for us is if you want to get 100,000 pages per week of review rate, make sure you have at least 100,000 pages loaded and available on the system with a good look ahead as to what the next week or two's worth of deliveries are so that you don't run the team out of inventory right away.
Kevin, how complicated is it to get all the different types of data and systems in the one repository and then opened up for review?
Well, Carl, I don't think it's really a question of complexity. I think it's more a question of time scales in the sense that you can do this quickly or you can do it safely. With all the case law that's out there, it's clear that things like metadata have to be looked at, and trying to take information out of one repository and put it into another one, you've got to make sure that your people have the time to do the proper conversions to be able to work with the data. You want to make sure that as they're going through the process, nothing is being altered, nothing is being amended. And you really want to question whether or not they really do need one repository. With the different types of data you have, there's nothing that says you can't have email in one repository, databases in a separate repository, and perhaps paper records in a third. So it goes back to the plan for how you're going to handle all of your data. It's not necessarily difficult, but it's definitely something that you have to take a look at closely.
Okay. Hey, I've just been advised that we need to talk a little louder, so just passing that on. Mr. Opsitnik, what dictates the manner in which you will produce documents to the other side? For example, TIFF and native file reviews are two different types of review options you frequently hear about.
Great. Thanks, Carl. Well, I think we need to split this in the question, broaden the question a little bit, because really, there are two issues. Do we review in native and produce in TIFF, or do we review in TIFF and produce in TIFF? I mean, there's really what form do you review the documents in, and then, of course, the issue is what do you produce them in. Obviously, the form that you're going to review them in is often dictated by the tool that you've chosen. Now, you don't want to necessarily put the tool that you've chosen before the decision's made as to how you're going to be able to produce these documents, and that's why I encourage people in the meet and the confer process to discuss this issue. You want to reduce the risk of surprise and cost. If later the other side says, hey, we thought we were going to get these documents in native form, and you've been reviewing them in TIFF and preparing to produce them in TIFF, you're going to increase your costs. Better to know that up front, have that battle up front and resolve it and figure out what the best approach is, rather than instead to do it one way and then find out at the end that the other side was expecting it in native.
Okay. I've also got one question, but I'm going to save these till the end, so keep sending the questions if you have them. The next section involves some of the other people on the panel. It's a staffing question on the hiring and training of the team. The facts that from the fact pattern are 120 contract attorneys and 10 team leaders who are contract attorneys that were hired directly by the firm and are generally just out of law school. These are the team leaders, started on the same day. Three agencies are used, all paying different rates. One agency has never met its candidates before but were recruited online. There was one day of training at a local hotel, and then the interaction with the law firm was minimal after that. Startup systems capture the work product, which was being reviewed by the firm's litigators. Jim, what's your reaction about how the team leaders were picked for the 4C project?
Too many Merlot drinkers was my first reaction. I think for buy-in purposes, it's really important that both in-house and outside counsel participate in the staffing process. I think some of the dangers can be, especially when a client actually goes ahead and almost like forces a staffing firm on a law firm. So one thing that really kind of jumped at me was, I think the term that was used in the scenario was, a partner acted as a project leader. Well, there's some great places for acting, but I don't think that's where you want to have a partner play, is the role of project leader. So my feeling is to really look for an associate level who has project management skills, and that's what's really required, I think, as far as a group leadership.
Okay. Dave, do you see any issues with having multiple agencies staffing the same project?
Yeah, I'd say there's at least three issues. One is just the logistics. It's certainly a lot easier to only deal with one agency than have to deal with multiple agencies. But I think other problems with this approach were reflected in your description. People sometimes underestimate how important the agencies are and the important functions that they fulfill. And in your example, you have one agency that hasn't even met the candidates. We rely on our outside temp agency to filter candidates to make sure that we're getting good people. So you want to have a company that is ensuring good quality in terms of the staffing. And then another issue that was raised by your hypothetical was the different rates that are being paid to the people staffing the project. You can be about 100% sure that once these people start working together, they're going to be talking about a number of things, including how much they're getting paid. And it can create a lot of morale problems when people sitting next to each other and doing the same work are being paid at different rates.
Okay, great. Tess, this is a quick one. Have you ever audited your staffing agency and asked the temps if they met the agency who supplied them?
Well, we haven't audited them per se, but we do have global agreements with several agencies. And so we have a standardized hiring and intake process that includes interviews, whether by phone or in person, of all of our candidates.
Okay. Tim, do you see any problems with starting 130 coding attorneys on the same day?
Well, sometimes circumstances dictate that you jump in with both feet, but that's really the exception rather than the rule. And as our fact pattern in this hypothetical proves out, when they ran out of documents for this size of team after 3 weeks, that might have not been the best decision. And that reinforces the point Tom made before about knowing the volume of the inventory prior to getting into the project and then keeping track as the project begins. I think under most circumstances, you're better off starting with a smaller core team, getting into the project that way. It provides a number of advantages, including, one, the fact that you have a smaller number of people getting into the documents and evaluating the content. No matter how good the training is, there are inevitable questions and issues that come up once the documents are actually being reviewed. And dealing with and resolving those questions with a smaller team and revising your training is much easier than dealing with questions from 130 people at once. The other point is just from a humanistic standpoint, I think it's easier to team build, to get a core team going and add to that team as the requirements of the project dictate. And it also allows you to identify and develop team leaders and those persons whom you might assign more substantive projects.
Good, thanks. Jim, what do you think about the fourth C's process, which had limited interaction between the firm and the contract attorneys?
Well, I got to tell you first, Carl, what scares me is like this is almost like my life story this past year, so I've got to try to depersonalize this a little bit. I think going back to what I was saying before, the law firm ultimately has the responsibility to the client in this relationship, and I think for there to be limited kind of interaction really goes ahead and limits their ability to represent the client fairly. So I think that kind of arrangement is just not going to be healthy whatsoever. And I would encourage, again, that the law firm would be the one to really kind of embrace the contract attorneys, set the tone for them, because ultimately it's the law firm that, again, owns that responsibility.
Tess, I know that when we were preparing you, you had some pretty strong thoughts on the treatment and skill sets of contract coders. I think it's fair to say the 4C project was fairly dehumanizing for the contract attorneys. Would you like to expand on your thoughts on why contract attorneys should be treated as professionals on a project?
I would. Having worked closely with contract attorneys for the better part of 10 years, I feel very strongly about the value that they can bring if they're properly treated. I'm oftentimes surprised at the popular misconception that I hear about the nature of contract attorneys. I'll sometimes hear that contract attorneys, you know, can't get work elsewhere, or are otherwise unemployable, and that simply hasn't been my experience. My experience has been that contract attorneys are licensed professionals who choose this line of work for a host of reasons, virtually a different reason for each person that I've worked with. And they're usually very good reasons. And as such, they oftentimes bring a wealth of experience, tenacity, commitment that can really add value to both the review and the overall case strategy if you let them. And you let them by making them an integral part of your team. One of the biggest mistakes that I've seen is trial teams that mistreat or marginalize the reviewers. Poor treatment will oftentimes result in morale, productivity, consistency, and overall quality problems that you can avoid. On the other hand, if your review attorneys are treated like professionals, if they're respected for their insight and otherwise integrated into the overall team, their productivity is maximized and the value that they bring to the project all inures to the benefit of the project, the team, and the client.
Okay, the next section is the technology one, setting up the war room. In the 4C scenario, the 4C in our law firm, we're building a war room for the project in vacant office space near the law firm, but it didn't have Internet access available immediately, so we tried to install a T1 line, but that was going to take 60 days into that space. So initially, we used a DSL line. We then rented computers and used 8 switches to connect the computers to the Internet. It was a real mess of wires. Tests of the system showed it was slow, and startup system was not working at all like the demonstration we saw. Then we called startup salesperson and suggested the problem was likely our setup and not their software. So we spent some time trying to figure out if this was plausible, which it was, but after determining that part of the problem had to be on startup's end, the salesperson then told us to call their help desk. They were helpful, and the system, after some tweaking, worked better, but coders still were kicked off periodically. Kevin, do you start a war room from scratch, or do you use existing war rooms? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, Carl, it's kind of tough. It's sort of like buying a car. On the one hand, if you've got the budget and you've got the time, you can jump in there and spend top dollar to set something up. You might be pretty well set. On the other hand, most of us probably have to buy used and try to suck up whatever we need to put in there in terms of upgrades and repairs later on. In looking at a war room that's already in existence, you probably want to take a look at what's available there in terms of bandwidth. Bandwidth is going to be one of your biggest issues. And it's not just the Internet bandwidth. It's also the local bandwidth on your local area network to make sure that all of your coders can get through there. You also want to take a look at the age of the equipment that's in that particular room. And you also want to closely scrutinize the licensing of all the software that are on those machines. Just because you take over a war room doesn't necessarily mean that you have the rights to use all the software that's in it. So there are a number of things that need to be analyzed. I guess basically if you've got some time and extra money, time being the biggest issue, you should build your own. On the other hand, if you're pressed for time, you're probably going to be forced to taking over something that's already in existence.
Great. Nice analogy, too. You're catching up to me on colorful analogies. Use cars. Mr. Opsitnik, can you add to Kevin's answer what can cause speed issues or slow performance on a project?
Sure, and this gets back to one of my earlier responses about whether you build it or rent it. And Kevin pointed out some of the problems with setting up a new war room. I mean, do you really have the staffing, the technology staffing who can determine what's wrong with your war room and maintain it properly as it needs to be? I mean, do you have certified Microsoft network engineers? I mean, the problems that can go wrong, we could talk about that for the next day, but they're basically on the desktop. They're part of the internal networking. They're part of your Internet service providers. For a couple examples of each, on your desktop, what are the security settings on your Internet browser? Are they set properly for the particular software at issue? We like to ask the software providers whether or not they have a specific setup that they suggest is run. Other issues, the network. Are they running hubs versus switches? Some of the old stuff that people used were hubs, which breaks and divides the speed up, rather than switches, which basically are intelligent tools to determine where the demand is and switches the bandwidth to the demand rather than sets it in the fashion that the hubs use. The Internet providers, that's another issue. Have they oversold the existing environment? Do they have too much demand in that geographic region? What are the age of their switches? What are the age of their equipment? So there are lots of issues that can bear on this, and having network engineers that can run speed tests to measure the speed at which packets of information go from one point to another will help you be able to rule out what the cause of the slowdown is or may be.
Chris, thanks a lot, Tim. Chris, is it unusual for the demonstration of the software to go much smoother, like startups did, than how the software actually performs with your live data?
I say absolutely not, Carl. In fact, it's probably expected. Demos are often done on laptops in controlled environments with sample data, even when things, even then things can go wrong, and I can tell you because I was in sales for a number of years, so I was involved in a few of those situations. The objective of a demo is to qualify the software features, the scalability of the software, its ability to meet your needs in terms of your anticipated process, and I would always suggest that you ask for a demo using your own data. Try to simulate your defined process. Ask questions regarding the subject matter expert in terms of their design of the software. Do you agree with the way they set up cases and their philosophy? That may go a long way to make you feel comfortable in areas that perhaps you can't test right away with their software, but give you confidence that they have the same strategy. I think another important part of this is how does the software vendor respond to any shortcomings that you bring up? Are they flexible? Do they embrace your input? Or do they just tell you what you want to hear?
Okay, Mr. Opsitnik, this is a 30-second question. What do you think of some of the specifications of the war room? Is using a DSL line or a T1 line adequate for 100 coding attorneys?
I think a T1 is probably adequate. I don't think a DSL line is adequate. I think a DSL line will present you with reliability problems. DSL lines typically go through switching stations, and those switching stations go down more often than you'd like to believe, or they'll tell you that they do. I've had personal experiences with running DSL lines and T1s. I would opt for a T1 today. There are lots of technology out there that's providing burstable products that are T1s and can burst to T3s. You should ask for those because on the rare occasion you need more, it's cheap insurance.
Okay. Tom, what are your thoughts about renting computers for a long-term project like we did here?
Well, assuming that clients like the 4C have not gone through a recent round of massive layoffs, you probably are not going to have more than 100 spare computers on hand, and so that will require the need to go out and acquire more equipment. As to rent versus lease versus purchase, I think Mr. Opsitnik has handled that adequately in his previous discussion. But taking a tip from IT 101, whether you do rent, lease, or purchase, make sure that you eliminate all the technical support variables that you can and eliminate the later downstream finger-pointing by insisting that all of the hardware have identical configurations. And then get one computer working exactly the way you want it to, and then proceed to replicate that software configuration across the rest of the computers.
Okay. I'm going to have to skip to the next section. We're a little behind here. So the next section, setting up the war room staffing, the key facts here were the coding location was not ready when the project started. So we put the coders around the law firm's offices and vacant offices, the library, and the conference rooms. The coders were told not to use the law firm's cafeteria because that was for the law firm personnel. When the project moved to the coding center, three new computers were stolen from the war room. The temperature, by the way, was unbearably hot in the war room. Air conditioning was expensive to rent after hours. The coders, by the way, were cramped together as the person who designed the room had never visited it but was actually concerned about getting the most bodies possible in one room so as not to be wasteful. Some coders were complaining. Boxes were arriving and there was no storage space available. And the building was complaining about boxes arriving on the weekend when the freight elevator was closed. Tim, what do you think about the thought process in setting up 4C's war room?
Well, in the hypothetical you summarized there, Carl, it doesn't seem like there was much thought process. In terms of treatment of the coders, my philosophy, and I think most people would echo this, is that the attorneys who are doing the document work should be treated as employees of your firm, just like any other employee. Even though there are legal distinctions in that they're contract individuals and are only there temporarily, I would certainly echo Tess's comments that in that my experience is these people who work on these projects are highly capable, motivated, professional individuals, and they need to be respected in that manner. So that goes into all the little details, such as the point you made about the cafeteria. You need to give thought to the war room. You don't want to put 20 or 30 people around one big table. Think about the facilities that are conducive to a good work environment. We've recommended and utilized on projects a Carroll-type setup where everybody has a little bit of individual workspace, but there is still a group environment where people can share information. There was a point also, I think, in the hypothetical about security. One has to give a lot of thought to security, both of the data for the client and then, of course, the facilities that are being used. There are a lot of details that have to be thought of, planned, and implemented prior to the project. It may not be something done at the higher partner level, but certainly someone in the firm running the project has to be delegated to attend to those tasks.
Seems sort of like an obvious question for you, Jim, but have you ever noticed how hot it gets in war rooms? You know, given that, do you have any sort of sense of what sort of thought should be put in the spacing of candidates?
Well, my partner, Mr. Upsitnik, just passed me a note and said that the coder should just suck it up in this case.
That's cruel.
Mr. Opsitnik is also 70 years old and was born back in the day, and that's not true.
He's got that warrior mentality. But nevertheless, having said that, I guess four letters come to mind when I read this, which was OSHA. I see some potential violations here on the OSHA side. And frankly, I think we've seen the dawn of development of professional war room providers, and a number of the staffing firms are now gotten into the FM business. So frankly, the more and more I see this, I don't want to touch this. I want to go to the people that know this, who are doing this on a again-and-again basis. They understand the safety precautions that are necessary, the OSHA requirements. So I don't think that went into the thinking with 4C and our established law firm in this case.
Okay, great. Just got another question, which we'll save here for the end. It's a good one, though. Tess, do you think having some space for storage is a good idea when undertaking a document review project, and do you have any advice there?
Sure. I think, you know, with all the emphasis on electronically stored information, you're still, as you have in this hypothetical, going to have your occasional box review. And so you're going to need to have, first of all, space for your boxes, supplies, and the like. Also, projects, even if they start out as well-defined electronic discovery projects, they can evolve. Oftentimes, our projects evolve from traditional electronic discovery document review to deposition digesting, creation of witness binders, and otherwise supporting the trial team, which is going to require supplies. More than that, though, it's going to require adequate space. So I would expand on my answer and tell you that you need adequate space, not just to accommodate lots of people in computers, but otherwise working areas.
Okay, great. And Dave, you know, one of my tips was to put someone like Bill Parcells running the war room. Why is that important?
Well, Carl, it's you know, in being involved in a number of these projects, it's amazing the differences that you can have in productivity between one team and another team reviewing the same kinds of documents. And it's really about, you know, put yourself in the place of these reviewers. Are they being treated like professionals? Is there a positive morale on the team? Is there a positive leadership? If people feel that they're part of a valuable effort and being treated with respect and being treated professionally, and that they have some goals in mind that they're trying to achieve, and if you have leadership pushing those goals, then they'll be much more productive and much more effective, and you'll ultimately get a better work product out of them.
Okay. The next section is a staffing area of leadership and management, and the key facts here in this scenario was the firm's partners didn't really address the team beyond the team's leaders. There's a team leader used for each coding team of 10 attorneys. The team leaders are given perks such as 3 meals a week in offices in front of the rest of the team. The team leaders walked around the coders making sure they're not speaking amongst themselves. The hours of operation were 9 to 5, meaning if lunch was taken, a coder could only work 7 hours in a day. The pay scale differences among the different coders and different agencies is now completely apparent to the entire team. In one agency with only 3 coders on the projects, actively recruiting other coders to join their agency, and they're paying about 30% more than anyone else. There are no bonuses or rewards paid to the coders because they are professionals, just like any other attorney at the firm. There's little or no feedback given to the coders. Morale is bad, and one coder quits in the middle of the day without notice. Dave, any reaction to the interaction between the partnership and the firm?
Well, again, that's a good follow-up to the question you asked me before. Morale is so important. People feeling that what they're doing is worthwhile is so important. And in too many projects, the reviewers feel like they are too far removed from the ultimate product and the ultimate litigation. One way to get around that is for there to be a presence by the attorneys that are running the case. And it can be invaluable for the senior partner who's running the case to come down and talk to the coders for a little while, talk to them about the case, and let them know that their work is important and that we care about their work. And not just, you know, that's excellent to do in the initial training, and the partner should also wander back there every so often to let everybody know that he still cares and to show that the team is really taking an interest in the work that they're doing.
Okay. Tim, is the structure of having one team leader per 10 coding attorneys conducive to leading the team?
In our hypothetical here, it seems like a reasonable allocation. In a smaller case or in one where the attorneys are more screening documents rather than analyzing them for production, you might get away with a bigger ratio of one leader to 20 attorneys. I think what you need to do is to look at the individual circumstances of the case, the type of work you're doing, the type of information that the discovery or trial team will need, and make those decisions from those facts.
Okay. Jim, do you see any problems with the hierarchy of perks on this project, special meals, offices, et cetera?
Well, on the positive side, perks can be helpful when it comes to retention of coders, reviewers. On the other hand, inconsistency can doom you, and I've been there. And I think we all know that there are truly contract attorney blogs out there, and if you're working with multiple firms as far as staffing these projects, word gets around that, hey, did you hear that such and such a firm, we can get this and this, but on ours we don't. So I think perks can be a good thing. It's the inconsistency as far as the use of those perks, especially when you're using with multiple staffing firms, that could be a problem.
Tess, does micromanaging behavior, sort of like no pack talking in the back row, like my ninth grade statistics teacher, Mrs. Pays, used to say to me, work on projects?
No, I don't think it does. I think it's a detriment to the morale. I think it's mistreating people who should be respected as professionals. Instead of, you know, walking around with the whip and having a proctor constantly in the room degrading people, what you ought to do is set clear expectations with your team at the outset. Everyone knows what their roles are, so that the expectation is that they will meet them. As the project evolves, the communication should remain open so that people can talk about their concerns. And overall, you want to create a pleasant environment. It ups the level of quality and consistency throughout the entire project. So mistreating people will get you inconsistent work. You'll probably have a lot of attrition in your group, which will kill your expectations as far as throughput and overall quality, whereas open communication and fair treatment will get you a lot further.
Jim, how relevant is feedback to a coding team on a project?
Well, Carl, in your case, I think Mrs. Pays needs to give you feedback, but other than that, I mean, I think it's obvious. I mean, having feedback so there's the consistency in the coding calls is really key. The only thing I just want to add to this is early testing of documents, you usually know that there's kind of like 10 to 15 document types that are going to be seen consistently by the reviewers. So if you can get a sense of how the coding protocol should be used for those documents, it can really avert a lot of the problems down the road with the consistency.
Okay. Tess, are there any advantages with having a single staffing agency provider, keeping benefits uniform, and developing a uniform reward system? And for times when you can't, I don't think you always can, how do you deal with that?
Well, there certainly are advantages, and I think your goal ought to be to have uniform benefits and rewards, you know, for purposes of simply being fair, to make sure that there's cohesion and a tight team on your projects. Oftentimes you can't simply because the resources available at a particular agency are not available to you. The way that we deal with it is we have arrangements with a small group of agencies where we have global agreements that look just like one another, so that we do have consistency in the uniform benefits and rewards that our teams get.
Okay. We're getting pretty close to a break here, but I want to get the questions that are coming in, make sure we answer them. So I'm going to throw out a question here, and I'm going to give it to Tom Stevens first. How do you deal with client IT staff who basically gives you a raspberry when you swoop in with a preservation and collection request?
Jeez, what a great question. First of all, respectfully, understanding that client IT staff are typically not that interested in the issues in the case because their lives are so busy doing what they're doing. From a vendor perspective, what's been helpful for us is to try to go in and offer to take the burden away from them in any way that we can. Try to be sympathetic as to what their current time schedules and demands are, and try to be flexible as to the things we can do and the hours in which we can work.
Okay. And we're going to get the last question here in a minute. We'll be right on schedule. Kevin, I'm going to give this one to you. Please define the roles and responsibilities of e-discovery project teams.
Oh, Lord, that's an awful big...
I'm giving you a
minute. Let's see, how many hours did we have for the call? Basically, the roles and responsibilities have to be agreed to up front, and they are based upon the capabilities of both your internal and external staff. You have to have a rules of engagement kind of document to start out with that lays out exactly how far the vendor will go into the internal IT's domain, where the internal IT people have to be the only ones that are touching systems and things of that nature. You should also have information as to who makes decisions at critical junctures, who decides to escalate issues, who decides to incur the wrath of the outside law firm by telling them they can't have their data as quickly as they want it. A lot of these things have to be planned up front, and although roles and responsibilities are something that people want to focus on, it really is tied both to the facts of the case, the type of litigation that you've got, or investigation if it's an investigation, and the capabilities of the parties involved.
Okay, I have 3 o'clock on my computer clock, which is official time here. Why don't we restart up again in 5 minutes? Just one quick point. We were talking about what a nightmare project this was, and while it's hard to imagine, although some of us felt like some of these projects have occurred that are similar to this in total, any one or two or three of the problems that have come up can really cause serious problems for a project. So anyway, moving ahead, Project Rough Start. Now it gets interesting with technology. When the project started on the first day, the team had to be sent home. The documents were in native format, and unfortunately the computers didn't have software such as MS Office on them to review the documents. The team stopped for 3 days while the computers were reloaded. Computers got viruses from unprofessional internet searching. It was learned a Java setting had to be upgraded to avoid being kicked out of startup systems. Our law firm's IT staff was stretched very thin by all of this upgrade work. The 17-inch bargain monitors we rented were not big enough to see documents and the coding field. Despite the slow pace, our large team got through so many documents that half of the coders had to be sent home for a week. Then we decided to downsize the team by 20%. Now scared, coders were leaving the project despite the fact there was still plenty of work to do, somewhere in the queue between collections and startup staging area. Startup also has experienced some problems with extensions on the computer files, so they were having trouble harvesting all the documents. Kevin, let's say you've done everything right in setting up the project, unlike this one, and choosing the best vendors on the best terms. How do you react to system problems on your projects?
Well, if you have done everything properly, it's going to be borne out by the way things go when things go wrong. Every project is going to have something go wrong. So it's how you react to it. And the first thing is you don't panic. You've got to make sure that people understand this is a possibility with every case, and it might come up. The second thing you need to do is take a look around the review room. If you see any senior attorneys there that are not directly related to the running of that review room, either get them out of the room or use duct tape to confine them to a chair somewhere, because you're going to spend most of your time either justifying your planning to them or having them get muddled in the middle of all the facts. Before you even open the review room, you should have a triage process put together where you know who the technical contacts are on both sides of the house, your house, and the people who are supplying you.
You need to know what the escalation process is for when things go wrong, and you need to know how long each level of support is going to work on an issue before it gets turned over to the next level of support. If you have all that laid out in the beginning, it's going to make any problems that come up a lot smoother to handle later on.
Okay. Mr. Opsitnik, how do you make sure your hardware is configured to start the project appropriately?
Well, this is an important issue because it really affects morale and increased costs if the hardware isn't functioning or it keeps things keep dropping. The first thing we do is we ask the software vendor that we're working with, do they have any known or do they have any specifications for how the internet browsers or the computers are supposed to be set up? And secondly, we ask them, do they have any known problems that they're aware of? And then we like to run a pilot test, go through with a small number of computers all the issues, and determine what's the best hardware configuration to use. Do we identify any problems? And then once we get that done, we'll actually take ghost copies of the hard drives, assuming we're using pretty much the same hardware throughout, which is something I recommend because it minimizes the ongoing costs and help desk sort of issues. And once we take a ghost copy of that, if somebody has a problem, we don't spend a lot of time fixing their problem. We just give them a new hard drive with all the configurations already replicated as part of that ghost hard drive.
Chris, who do you think is coordinating the people and the technology needs on a project? Because I think, I mean, you're on the law firm perspective. Earlier, I think Tom had said he'd like a hand as a technology company in telling you, as a law firm, how many coders you should have on it.
Well, every project's different. You need to consider the how the technology is housed. Is it managed in house? Is it hosted by an ASP or provided, you know, by an agency that you're using for your contract attorneys as well? On a project we're currently working on, the management's a combination of a number of things. It's we use paralegals and attorneys for the process instructions and the management of the contract attorneys. You know, the actual process of relevancy review, subjective coding, et cetera. We have a litigation support staff that is involved in systems design, managing vendors, and providing the flow of work for review, and a primary vendor that's been very effective in terms of project management and consultative advice. Areas that I would like to point out that need to be clearly defined, or some of the areas, is who adjusts the contract attorney group size up and down based on your flow of work. You essentially have the same problem that vendors have. Do you staff for the peaks? Do you staff for the valleys? Who oversees the productivity and quality aspects of the reviewers? And who's accountable for the treatment and morale? We know that the attorneys work closely with the contract attorneys in terms of process. But, for instance, the system goes down an hour after everybody shows up for work. How do you handle that to keep morale where you want it to be?
Okay. We're getting a bunch of questions, which is great. Tess, this is a staffing issue wrapped up in a technology issue, but when you send a significant percentage of staff home, like half, and then 20% get downsized due to inadequate workflow, you know, what does that do with your morale on your team and your ability to mold them into a dedicated, motivated, you know, team?
Well, obviously it can be devastating. I mean, it destabilizes the team. I think Tim was talking about this earlier. You're going to have problems of attrition because people, you know, contract attorneys, but for the legal nature of their relationship with the firm, they want to work, they want to be employed. And so when you begin to lay people off, they become insecure in whether or not they can look forward to long-time engagement with the firm. So it creates attrition issues, it creates turnover. You'll see reduced focus on your teams, perhaps, you know, a perceptible decrease in the amount of commitment. These are, of course, natural responses to insecurity in your job. You want to avoid that whenever possible, and I think Tim's suggestion was that probably at the outset of a project you want to understaff as opposed to overstaffing, and I completely agree with that. You can always add more people to meet your deadlines and thereby avoid some of the issues of having to lay off. But at the end of the day, have enough respect for your team to let them know what's going on. to tell everyone and be as transparent as you can be about why you're making the management decisions that you're making and what they can expect going forward. And I think that that can go a long way towards minimizing the damage.
Okay, I'm going to go into the next section now, which is internal controls on a staffing side. The key facts here are the coders could not enter the room after 5, and one is actually turned away at 5.05 p.m. Keypads were used, so when coders left the room for bathroom breaks, they were no longer billing. They could protect against that. No one was fired on the project, despite some noticeable shoddy work habits. Due to quick deadlines, we had to produce without coding and go back and code documents. You know, as a result, we did less quality review work to save money because 4C was concerned about spending too much time reviewing documents. The quality review work was done sort of on the fly by team leaders walking around the room, answering questions, and occasionally giving updates. We did, however, do a little bit more QC work once things settled down a bit, and then we had some quality concerns, so our firm recommended doing some more focused quality review work on batches of documents reviewed by all the attorneys. Dave, how tight should internal controls be over the team? Card swipes, strict time monitoring?
Well, I think that as in many other areas, common sense should prevail, and you need to find a balance. On the one hand, certainly you want to let employees know that, you know, they're there to work, and you can't allow breaks that extend too long. But to make somebody punch a clock or swipe in and out every time they want to take a one-minute bathroom break, I think is overkill, and it's particularly overkill in the factual scenario you've given, where people seem to be penny wise and pound foolish. They're paying attention to these little issues that don't have a big cost impact, and then they're ignoring the kinds of quality control they should be doing that can have a huge financial impact. You got to focus on the important issues and the big picture.
Okay. Jim, do you give hiring and firing responsibility to team leaders who are in the war room, or do you centralize the function and make headcount decisions at the beginning of a project, or as workflow occurs? Yeah, if you have enough work or not enough work.
Sure. I think the answer to that question, Carl, is who the team leaders are first. If this is team leadership from what I'm again calling these professional war room providers, being staffing firms or companies that really are specializing in document review, I would ask them first for a staffing plan. So given the size of what the document project is, I would expect something in terms of it would be X number of hours, it could be completed X number of weeks and the like. So that's what I'm looking for, is a staffing plan. And the second piece I'd be looking for from these corps, I guess I'll call them, is performance standards and performance metrics. So I want to be able to hear from them how are the quality control rates and also how are the productivity rates. So I have found that a number of these firms are doing this, they have no kind of these type of measurements in place, and I'd be very leery about working with those type of companies.
Okay. Actually, we're going to go into the next section because we're getting so many great questions here. On quality controls with technology, as I mentioned before, initially the QCing was done by the team leaders hovering over the team. Startup software, unfortunately, did not provide much in the way of reports to look for patterns of unusual activity from coders or other QC tools. And we were never able to establish any metrics to measure performance. Startup responded to us their lack of tools was because most of their R&D went into improving their search tools to find relevant documents. Kevin, what's your thought on who's best situated to oversee quality controls, the law firm, the technology provider, or the corporate client?
I think it's a shared responsibility of both the law firm and the corporate client. The technology provider usually is just providing you with tools, as you've mentioned. There's not really a hell of a lot that they can change on the fly to make their products act differently. So there's not a lot of benefit to try to make those changes there. The law firm, obviously, if they're running the review room, they're working on the case, they're the closest to the information flow, and they should be able to highlight things as quickly as possible. The corporate client, however, doesn't have the ability of just abdicating their responsibilities and say, I'll check with you midway through the case or near the end of the case to see if there's anything more we can provide to you or if you're getting enough of the proper information in order to build the case. It really is, I think, there's a lot of information out there in case law The Morgan Stanley case, for example, points out that, you know, outside counsel has to continually question inside people as to what they're doing and how, and you can't wait on that. You have to have a shared view on that, and you have to have a shared work team to be looking at it straight from the beginning.
Jim, is working as a team leader and doing quality control work the same job?
I guess it can be, but I really see it as two separate. I think the team leader is often the liaison with, be it the law firm or the client, or the two could be combined. And I think that the quality control work really has to be a separate kind of function there. So I think they probably are a division of responsibilities. It really depends on the size of the project. I think there's a division there, Carl.
Okay. Mr. Opsetnik, this kills me every time I say that to him, but anyway, how do you use your software to assist with quality control efforts?
It's often very difficult. What I have found is that most software products out there, this is the one item that they're very immature on. They simply have not taken into account workflow issues and metrics for measuring productivity and quality control as well as they should have. And I am encouraging more and more companies today to build them into their review tools and to take all aspects of that into consideration. We often find ourselves trying to do things on the back end, taking information out of the databases themselves and not using the software tools and the things that the tools on the front end are permit you to do by virtue of the screens that come with the tools. So I think it's very difficult.
Okay, great. Tom, do you see software vendors addressing the lack of management tools for these projects, or is the focus still building the best search engines?
Well, I think Mr. Opsetnik's absolutely right with his previous comments in that this is a very immature area in software development. I think that people are still working on cool features more than they're working on practical features. There are some basic tools that are available for doing fairly simple productivity analysis and also some tools available for helping to implement workflow and how documents might flow from one reviewer to a QC to a secondary privilege of that sort. But one thing I would like to perhaps take a slightly different point of view than Mr. Opsetnik is I would not look for the software vendors to come up with the solutions for all of the quality control needs. I think there's going to need greater understanding of what quality control is and how to implement quality control so that you can actually develop a confidence in the statistics that you're generating.
Okay. Into the next section, the project midpoint with production and depositions. On the technology side, the server speed was slowing down on the project, and we think startup is moving some of their equipment to other projects. We encounter fewer problems now, but it takes longer for startup to solve them. We still have no idea how many documents are in the queue, and the coders have identified one email they've seen 200 times and been unable to dedupe. Very troubling. Is 200 documents, which were identified as error documents and sent back to startup, were lost sight of, and startup sent the documents back to us after the witness had been deposed. To hit a deadline on one production, we decided to use startup's innovative search tools to identify documents as privileged, and with an impending deadline, we used this to finish the production and accidentally release some privileged documents, which had never been reviewed by coders. At this point, outside counsel and startup are pointing fingers at each other to foresee management, blaming the other for inefficiencies, and we do not know who to believe. We still don't know how long the project's going to take. Kevin, who should be tracking the amount of work in the pipeline to keep the team fully occupied?
I'm getting very suspicious because I keep getting a lot of project management questions. Really, you've got three sections here of your team that have to work together and have to communicate in a real-time basis. You've got your preservation and collection people who should be harvesting your initial data. You have your either internal or external processors that might be tipping information or putting it into a database or putting it into a repository. And then you have the people that are doing the review. And clearly, if the people that are in the review area see that they're running out of documents, they should immediately be making questions to the people that are processing. What do you have in your queue? The people who are processing should be asking the people that are doing collection, is there something more you need to collect, or do we have everything that you've committed to get to us? A lot of these things depend upon rapid and frequent communication. between all these teams in order to try to figure out how much information is in the pipeline and where they can find it. So it's really quite a number of people working within your team to make sure that at any point in time you just don't run out of work.
Tim, what's the risk of having nobody review documents before releasing them and relying on software?
I think that question almost answers itself. There's a lot of risk. If you're relying on software to screen documents, particularly with regard to privilege, you run a risk of waiving the privilege. There is a recent decision, 2005 decision, issued in the District of Delaware in a case called Hopkins versus Mayor of Baltimore, where the court talks about these issues, notwithstanding, as in many cases now, where the parties privately agree, reach an agreement that a post-production privilege review will allow a producing party to snatch back inadvertently produced privileged documents. The court points out that that may not protect it when applying the established law relating to waiver of privilege. So relying on technology alone to conduct your privilege review does have its risk. And of course, just the practical point, even if a snatchback agreement is allowed, as a practical matter, your opponent has seen the privileged document and at least has that information, even if they can't actively use it in the case. Just another quick point, relying on software only, you're putting yourself in a disadvantage in that you are producing the documents to your opponent before you've had a chance yourself to really determine what are the important items of information within the documents and what investigation is needed to follow up on that information. I think most trial counsel would tell you they would like to have a very good handle on the content of the document before they produce the document set to the other side.